In the world of high finance, where aggressive growth strategies and relentless expansion typically dominate headlines, capital returns offers a refreshingly contrarian perspective. This collection of essays from Marathon Asset Management has quietly become something of an underground classic among value investors since its 2015 publication. While it never reached the mainstream popularity of books like The Big Short, industry insiders consider it required reading. Warren Buffett reportedly keeps a copy on his desk, and Seth Klarman has called it essential for understanding how markets really work. What makes this book particularly fascinating is how it challenges conventional investment wisdom by focusing not on forecasting demand, which most investors obsess over, but on analyzing supply, specifically how capital flows into and out of industries determine future returns. In an era where everyone from Reddit day traders to hedge fund managers chase the next hot sector, Marathon's disciplined approach of avoiding capital-flooded industries while seeking opportunities where capital is exiting offers a powerful antidote to market hysteria. At the heart of Marathon's investment philosophy lies the capital cycle, a fundamental pattern that drives returns across industries and markets. This cycle begins when companies in a particular sector earn returns exceeding their cost of capital. These high returns attract attention. CEOs become business celebrities, analysts issue enthusiastic buy recommendations, and management teams, emboldened by success, announce major capacity expansions. Investment banks eagerly arrange financing, and growth investors pile in, excited by rising earnings projections. Fast forward 5 years, and the picture often looks dramatically different. The once celebrated CEO resigns under pressure from activist investors. Profits have collapsed along with the share price. The industry suffers from excess supply as competitors expanded capacity simultaneously while new low-cost producers entered the market. Demand growth has slowed, particularly in emerging markets that were supposed to provide endless opportunity. The company considers merging with rivals to survive, while most analysts have abandoned coverage. This predictable pattern reveals how high profitability leads to overconfidence. Managers frequently confuse favorable industry conditions with their own skill. Both executives and investors make demand projections with systematic biases, overly optimistic in good times, excessively pessimistic in bad. High returns loosen capital discipline, encouraging increased spending that competitors often match. Investment bankers facilitate this cycle, helping expand capacity during booms and consolidate industries during busts, while focusing on short-term fees rather than long-term consequences. The lag between capital spending and production creates lumpy supply changes prone to overshooting. As excess capacity becomes apparent and demand forecasts prove overly optimistic, profits collapse, management changes, capital expenditure gets cut, and industry consolidation begins. For investors who understand the capital cycle, this downturn creates potential opportunities, though most analysts and short-term investors miss the turning point. The capital cycle pattern repeats across numerous industries, though some sectors are particularly susceptible to destructive boom-bust dynamics. Semiconductors and airlines stand out as classic examples, with frequent excess capacity and consistently disappointing returns. During the tech boom of the late 1990s, telecommunications companies operated on the false assumption that internet traffic doubled every 100 days, justifying enormous capital spending by companies like WorldCom and Global Crossing. After the bubble burst, networks were plagued with massive excess capacity, called dark fiber, destroying shareholder value. The global shipping industry provides another textbook example. Between 2001 and 2007, daily rates for Panamax ships rose tenfold as China's increasing share of global trade boosted demand. The inevitable supply response followed. The global dry bulk fleet doubled between 2004 and 2009. Combined with the global economic slowdown, this led to a 90% collapse in daily rates. Investors who bought shipping stocks in mid-2007 lost two-thirds of their money, and the industry continued to suffer from poor capacity utilization for years afterward. Perhaps most dramatic was the commodity supercycle that took off after the 2002 dot-com bust. Rising commodity prices were propelled by China's investment-heavy economy with double-digit GDP growth. After the financial crisis, China's investment share of GDP rose to an extraordinary 50%, accounting for over 40% of global demand for many commodities, including iron ore, coal, zinc, and aluminum. Commodity prices soared to bubble levels, driving mining companies' returns on capital from 7.5% to nearly 35%. This profitability surge, combined with optimistic forecasts about China's continued growth, spurred massive production increases. Global mine production rose 20% annually between 2000-2011, with mining capital expenditure climbing more than fivefold to over $160 billion. New entrants flooded the market, including Australia's Fortescue Metals and numerous smaller mining companies. The cycle turned in 2011 as China's growth slowed, with iron ore prices falling 70% from their peak, while new mining capacity continued coming online, further contributing to overcapacity. Why does this pattern repeat so consistently? Recent academic research confirms the inverse relationship between capital expenditure and investment returns. Companies with the lowest asset growth consistently outperform those with the highest asset growth, what finance professors call the asset growth anomaly. This market inefficiency can be explained through several behavioral finance concepts. Overconfidence plays a key role. Investors and corporate managers are infatuated with asset growth. Corporate expansion fires the imagination of both managers and shareholders, reflected in the historically poor performance of stocks with higher growth expectations. Both groups are prone to overconfidence when making forecasts, especially regarding future demand levels. Competition neglect occurs when multiple industry players increase capacity simultaneously, failing to consider how increasing supply affects future returns. This blindness is particularly strong when firms receive delayed feedback about their decisions. Managers so overestimate their own skills, they neglect competitive threats, focusing on current and projected profitability while ignoring changes in the industry's asset base. Decision makers often take the inside view, focusing on specific circumstances rather than considering broader reference classes. Analysts with specialized industry knowledge are particularly prone to this, assuming their case is unique. The outside view, looking for relevant historical parallels, is rarely used despite its value. As Michael Mobison notes, the outside view is unnatural because it forces analysts to set aside cherished information they've unearthed about a company. Our tendency to extrapolate recent trends compounds these problems. We anchor on information presented to us and are overly influenced by recent experiences. We draw strong inferences from small samples and make linear forecasts despite the cyclical nature of most economic activity, trade cycles, credit cycles, liquidity cycles, real estate cycles, profit cycles, commodity cycles, venture capital cycles, and industry capital cycles. Marathon resists being labeled a value manager because it oversimplifies their investment approach. While traditional value investors seek stocks with low price multiples, PE, price to book, Marathon's portfolios often contain companies with relatively strong earnings growth despite below average multiples. Their approach acknowledges that value can be found across the investment spectrum, not just in statistically cheap stocks. The value-growth distinction is further blurred by how leading value investors like Warren Buffett have championed growth companies, believing them to be undervalued relative to future returns. Buffett's investments in Coca-Cola, American Express, and more recently Apple demonstrate how quality growth companies can represent excellent value when purchased at reasonable prices. Marathon's capital cycle analysis recognizes that growth stocks often become value stocks after excess capital, attracted by high profitability, eventually reduces returns. This transformation can be seen in industries like semiconductors, where periods of high growth and profitability typically attract new capacity, leading to eventual price compression. Investing fundamentally concerns price and value, buying stocks at a discount to intrinsic value. While theoretically value derives from discounted future cash flows, our poor predictive abilities make detailed forecasting problematic. The technology sector provides numerous examples where seemingly reasonable growth projections proved wildly optimistic during the dot-com bubble. Many value investors respond by using simple proxies like price-to-book, PE ratios, and free cash flow yield. While useful indicators, these measures overlook specific contexts like business models, industry structure, and capital allocation that determine future cash flows. For instance, software companies often show poor traditional value metrics despite having highly profitable, capital-light business models. Marathon looks for opportunities among both value and growth stocks where the market misjudges the pace of profit reversion to the mean. For value stocks, they bet profits will rebound faster than expected, as seen in cyclical industries like mining during downturns. For growth stocks, they seek companies where profits will remain elevated longer than anticipated, such as dominant platform businesses with strong network effects. The firm has increasingly invested in companies with strong competitive advantages, what Warren Buffett calls wide moats, that can maintain high profitability by repelling competition. These companies defy mean reversion because lack of competition prevents supply-side shifts despite high returns. Examples include payment networks like Visa and MasterCard, whose entrenched positions and network effects create lasting advantages, or luxury goods companies like LVMH, whose brand value and heritage create persistent pricing power. Such businesses can sustain above-average returns for decades, making traditional value metrics less relevant to their evaluation. Marathon's approach demonstrates that successful investing requires looking beyond simple categorizations and understanding the fundamental drivers of business value and competitive dynamics. Their framework recognizes that value can be found in both traditionally cheap stocks and premium-priced companies with sustainable competitive advantages. Some of Marathon's most successful investments have been in companies that benefit from what Charles Munger calls agency problems. Situations where customers aren't directly involved in purchasing decisions, allowing higher prices to actually increase sales volumes by incentivizing intermediaries. This dynamic creates a unique economic moat where traditional price sensitivity becomes inverted, as higher prices can actually drive increased adoption through the incentive structure. Geberit, a Swiss sanitary systems manufacturer, exemplifies this model through its relationship with plumbers. These professionals welcome price increases since they earn percentage-based commissions on installations. This alignment of interests has created a virtuous cycle of innovation and premium pricing. A third of Geberit's sales come from products introduced in the last 3 years, generating consistent 15% operating margins. Their premium products, like wall-mounted toilets and sophisticated shower systems, command prices 30-40% above competitors while maintaining market leadership. The healthcare sector presents multiple compelling examples of successful agency models. Dental implant manufacturers Nobel Biocare and Straumann have built powerful positions by constantly innovating products that allow dentists to earn higher revenues. Nobel Biocare maintains 24% margins through premium pricing on advanced implant systems, while dentists benefit from being able to charge $3,000 to $5,000 per implant procedure. In hearing aids, companies like William Demant achieve 20-plus margins by developing customized, high-end products that hearing aid fitters can charge premium prices for, often $2,000 to $4,000 per device. The fitter's expertise in customization and fitting becomes part of the value proposition, justifying higher prices to end users. Intertek's lab test subsidiary demonstrates perhaps the purest form of this model. U.S. retailers select them to inspect Chinese manufacturers' products, but the Chinese firms pay the fees, creating a perfect separation between service selection and payment. This arrangement helps generate remarkable 33% margins while maintaining high standards, as LabTest's true customer is the selecting retailer, not the paying manufacturer. These agency-exploiting business models have proven remarkably durable despite increasing consumer information and transparency. They represent a subset of businesses with intrinsic pricing power, where price isn't the customer's primary consideration. The most attractive economics emerge when these advantages combine with products whose cost is low relative to their importance, like analog semiconductor chips activating car airbags for just over a dollar, or medical devices where the product cost is minimal compared to the procedure's overall cost and importance to patient outcomes. This combination of agency advantage and critical function creates sustainable competitive positions that have consistently delivered superior returns for investors. While typical growth stocks eventually stumble when competition intensifies, certain unglamorous companies prove exceptional investments when they provide essential services that customers barely notice paying for. These under-the-radar businesses sell products that represent a tiny portion of customers' costs, yet are vitally important to them. For example, a semiconductor component might cost just pennies, but be crucial to a $1,000 electronic device's functionality. Or a specialty chemical might comprise less than 1% of a product's cost while being indispensable to its performance. Malathon has identified such companies across diverse industries. Analog semiconductor makers Linear Technologies and Analog Devices, whose components are essential for power management and signal processing in countless electronic devices. Payroll processors Paychex and ADP, which handle critical but low-cost payment services for millions of employees. Software companies Aveva and Dassault Systèmes, whose design tools are deeply embedded in their customers' engineering processes. Specialty chemical producers like Croda and Victrex create unique compounds that become essential ingredients in everything from cosmetics to aerospace components. Laboratory suppliers Waters, Powell Corporation, and Mettler-Toledo provide precision instruments and consumables that researchers rely on daily. Engineering firms Rotork, Spirax-Sarco, and IMI deliver specialized industrial components that, while small in cost, are crucial for plant operations. These businesses combine high perceived value with multiple layers of competitive protection. Their barriers to entry include significant economies of scale, where large established players can spread R&D costs across broad customer bases. Complex regulatory hurdles, particularly in medical and industrial applications, and high switching costs once customers integrate their products into their processes. Their technical selling approaches often involve qualified engineers and scientists working directly with customers' R&D departments, creating deep relationships that competitors struggle to displace. Many maintain extensive distribution networks and service infrastructures that would be expensive and time-consuming to replicate. While their consistent profitability doesn't escape investors' notice, Marathon has sometimes hesitated at their seemingly premium valuations, only to watch share prices double or triple afterward. The lesson? A seemingly full price is often justified for these high-quality businesses because their competitive advantages tend to strengthen over time, and their pricing power remains robust even in challenging economic conditions. Their essential nature means customers rarely switch providers to save small amounts, providing reliable, recurring revenue streams that compound over decades. Marathon emphasizes Warren Buffett's observation that after 10 years, a CEO whose company retains 10% of net worth annually will have deployed over 60% of all capital in the business. This underscores why investors should carefully evaluate management's capital allocation skills. As Marathon's investment holding periods have extended, the firm has increasingly recognized that managerial skill in capital allocation is decisive to investment outcomes. Face-to-face meetings and general observation of management have become core elements of Marathon's daily work. The ideal corporate manager understands his industry's capital cycle and maintains interests aligned with outside investors. Corporate management consistently exhibits pro-cyclical behavior, buying high and selling low with their own equity. As markets peaked in 2007, companies spent record amounts on overvalued acquisitions and share buybacks, only to raise fresh capital at market lows. European building materials groups like Holcim, Lafarge, and Saint-Gobain invested $46 billion at cycle peak 2005-2006, then raised nearly $10 billion at market lows in 2009 after making disposals. By contrast, Bjorn Walros of Sampo demonstrated exceptional capital allocation skills through several strategic moves, selling Nokia shares at 35 before they fell to 7.2, creating a pan-Nordic P&C insurance business that improved its combined ratio from 105% to 90%, buying out partners at $2.4 billion, now valued at $4 to $9 billion, selling Finnish retail banking to Danske Bank at peak market prices of $4.1 billion, and reducing equity exposure before the Lehman crisis while investing $8 to $9 billion in distressed corporate bonds afterward. Capital cycle analysis draws deeply from Schumpeter's concept of creative destruction, where economic recessions serve a vital cleansing function by eliminating weak businesses and allowing stronger ones to thrive. This natural process, essential for long-term economic health, has historically driven innovation and efficiency. However, European policymakers have consistently prevented necessary consolidation in politically sensitive sectors like automotive manufacturing, steel production, and continental banking, creating persistent market distortions. Low interest rates have become a critical barrier preventing necessary creative destruction across European industries. Excess capacity built during the credit boom persists as artificially cheap money keeps zombie companies alive. The Bank of England reports 5 to 7% of mortgages in forbearance, while 10% of British businesses survive only due to loose monetary policy. The European auto industry exemplifies this problem dramatically, with companies like Peugeot trading at a tenth of book value, yet unable to close underperforming plants due to intense political resistance. Similar situations exist in Spanish construction, Italian textiles, and German shipbuilding. Unlike previous downturns where rising interest rates forced bankruptcies and necessary consolidation, today's prolonged low rates allow weak firms to survive with fundamentally unsustainable debt levels. This creates a cascade of negative effects: reduced productivity, misallocation of capital, and decreased market dynamism. Politicians compound the problem by protecting manufacturing jobs out of nostalgia and electoral concerns, especially in Europe, where nationalism prevents rational industry consolidation. The question becomes particularly thorny. Why should a French automaker close capacity when benefits would accrue to Italian competitors? This political economy challenge has created a gridlock where necessary restructuring remains perpetually delayed. Chinese state capitalism has created additional complications by designating numerous strategic industries and building massive excess capacity in sectors from solar power to telecommunications equipment, steel production, and electric vehicle manufacturing. This state-directed overcapacity floods global markets, further distorting natural market cycles and preventing necessary industry consolidation. New technologies have further disrupted traditional capital cycles, as seen with the Internet's devastating impact on music distribution, newspapers, traditional retail, and bookselling. The rise of digital platforms has created winner-take-all dynamics that bypass traditional capital cycle patterns. The persistence of zombie firms creates broader economic inefficiencies. They tie up human capital, maintain excess capacity that depresses prices, and prevent the reallocation of resources to more productive uses. Studies from the Bank for International Settlements suggest that zombie firms reduce productivity growth by as much as 0.7% annually in affected sectors. Moreover, their continued existence delays necessary structural reforms and impedes the development of more innovative business models. Given Marathon's focus on rational capital allocation and supply-side discipline, the firm has made few investments in mainland Chinese equities. Many Chinese companies are state-controlled, subordinating capital efficiency and minority shareholder interests to state policy objectives. From both macro and micro perspectives, China exemplifies problematic capital cycle dynamics, pushing investment as a percentage of GDP to unprecedented levels, even exceeding former Asian high flyers like South Korea and Japan. This has predictably reduced factor productivity, a problem worsened by Beijing's crisis-era decision to further increase fixed asset investment. Despite China's 25-year industrialization being the defining business event for many in capital markets, Marathon has avoided material investments there, a decision vindicated by poor returns. A dollar invested in the Hang Seng China Enterprises Index in 1993 would be worth just 35 cents today, despite China's rapid economic growth. This disconnect stems from government-directed growth prioritizing development over efficient capital allocation. China's state capitalism model features some 600 central SOEs working with local governments, often competing with each other. Two unique characteristics make China's model problematic. Corporate capital comes primarily from banks, where loan repayment seems optional, and provincial rivalry creates redundant projects nationwide. China's economic growth comes from increased inputs rather than improved productivity, with investment spending comprising over 40% of the economy. The combination of cheap capital, excessive investment, and the failure of capital to exit low-return industries has made China largely uninvestable for capital cycle investors like Marathon, explaining why shareholder returns have been disappointing despite strong economic growth. Marathon's capital cycle approach naturally makes them wary of investment bankers who supply capital to hot market areas and generate fees from dubious financial engineering activities harmful to long-term shareholders. Writing to clients in September 2000, Marathon predicted that investment banks' excesses would worsen because they were too large and too well connected to fail, a forecast realized 8 years later with Lehman Brothers' collapse. Investment bankers facilitate the capital cycle, helping expand capacity during booms and consolidate industries during busts, while focusing on short-term fees rather than long-term consequences. During the private equity boom of the mid-2000s, banks offered unprecedented lending terms, 9x EBITDA, with bankers focused solely on syndication fees rather than credit quality. European LBO borrowing doubled in 2005 and was poised to double again as the industry raised $250 billion worldwide. This behavior creates what Marathon calls the daisy chain economics of LBO to LBO transactions, where private equity firms sell companies to each other at ever higher prices, generating fees at each step while eliminating exit concerns. The window eventually closes as institutions realize they're paying high fees for leveraged versions of companies they already own. Tax authorities notice the leverage game, and regulators grow concerned. Marathon remains skeptical of investment bankers, recognizing their role in driving capital cycles without concern for negative long-term consequences. As Benjamin Graham noted, brokerage houses rarely point out when popular industries are heading for a fall or unpopular ones are due to prosper. The effective capital cycle analyst must be contrarian and skeptical of Wall Street's siren call.